14. Poirot makes a task list. Well? I spluttered, trying to avoid swallowing a mouthful of water. Did you ask Hester Semmeling how a book belonging to Daisy Devonport came to be in her house? I was swimming in Kingfisher Hill's famous Victor Marclus swimming pool. Poirot walked on the grass beside me, 65 feet up and 65 feet down again, and we talked as I swam. Poirot had suggested this, so that time is not wasted by your aqueous pursuits, Catchpool. I tried to persuade him to join me, but he had refused, insisting that the water would be icy cold. It was not. The pool was heated to a temperature that was eminently bearable, as long as one never stood still in it. Remarkably, I had it all to myself. I was not able to swim as fast as I would have liked, however. I had to slow down to match Poirot's walking pace. Still, it was wonderfully invigorating at any speed. There's nothing like a swim in the outdoors, with fresh air and water on your face. You really should try it, Poirot, I had told him a few moments ago. It's invaluable for clearing the head. My head is in no need of clearing, he had replied. And if you cannot say the same of yours, you should devote yourself not to frolicking in water like a dog, but to arranging your thoughts more carefully in future, with the order and the method. Have I not always told you this? Now, he said. Of course, I asked about the book. Why do you assume that it was Daisy Devonport's copy of Midnight Gathering that ended up at Kingfisher's View? It was not. It was a copy that had been given by Daisy to Werner La Violette as a gift. Werner had read and enjoyed it, then passed it on to Hester Semmeling. So Daisy has both received it as a gift and given it as a gift, I said, trying as we spoke to keep track of the number of lengths of the pool I'd swum. It was hard to count and talk at the same time. She has given it not only to Werner La Violette, said Poirot. According to Hester Semmeling, she also gave a copy to Oliver Proud after he accepted her proposal of marriage. When she gave it to Werner, she apparently told her that it was her favorite book in the world. She said, I give this book to all the most important people in my life. I have now read parts of it myself. It seems to be an interesting tale of a most unsympathetic and enervating family. No wonder Daisy Devonport likes it so much, I said. Tell me, Catchpool, why do you say that Mademoiselle Daisy, as well as giving Midnight Gathering as a gift, has also received it as one? I stopped swimming and looked at him. Surely he could not have forgotten. She told you on the coach when you sat next to her. She said the copy of the book that she had with her, the one I'd angered her by looking at, had originally been a gift from, and then she stopped before telling you from whom it had been a gift. You are right in every detail. This is fascinating, is it not? What, that she was first given it and then, presumably, liked it so much that she gave it to others? I can't see anything remarkable about that. What interests me far more is the name of the author. How could I have failed to notice it? It must have been right there on the cover beneath the title. It was the first thing Poirot had said to me when we met after his visit to Hester Semmeling. You will not believe me, Catchpool, when I tell you the name of the author of Midnight Gathering. That book was written by a woman called Joan Blythe. Yes, I assure you, I am in earnest. Now, I said, I wonder if that's why our Joan Blythe was so scared when she heard me say Midnight Gathering on the coach. She'd not mentioned having written or published a book, and suddenly I came out with the title. She might have thought, well, I don't know what she might have thought, but I can see it might make her shake a little. You told me that she was terrified, not merely shaken, Poirot reminded me. Also, you are assuming that Joan Blythe from the motor coach is the same Joan Blythe who wrote the book. There is no reason to suppose this. Either way, a coincidence of this magnitude, it's impossible. Either we have Daisy travelling with a copy of Midnight Gathering, and then happening to sit next to a woman who's the author of that very book, or, even less likely, Daisy sits next to a woman who is not the writer of the book she's reading, but who has exactly the same name as the book's author. Catchpool, Catchpool. Poirot sighed. You still do not see what is so clear. Suddenly I did, or I thought I did. Joan Blythe might not have been the real name of the woman on the coach, I said. She didn't want to tell us her real name. Having seen Daisy's book and noted the name of its author, she gave Joan Blythe as her false name. Sometimes, my friend, I despair of you, said Poirot. Yes, she might very well have picked Joan Blythe as her assumed name, having seen it on Mademoiselle Daisy's book. But how can you see this and not see the rest of the picture? I put my head under the water and swam as fast as I could to the far edge of the pool, then back again to where Poirot was standing still, waiting for me. Surfacing, I said, The woman in the Devonport's drawing room with her head smashed to smithereens. Was that Joan Blythe from the coach, as I suppose I must call her from now on, to distinguish her from Joan Blythe the author? Or was it not? Officially, she has not yet been identified, I know. Nevertheless, you have an opinion. You think you know who she is. You wish to be included in my provisional thoughts, said Poirot. Very well. Yes, the dead woman is, as you call her, Joan Blythe from the coach. Her real name is not Joan Blythe, and she was most decidedly not the author of Midnight Gathering. Then who was she? Poirot smiled. Soon, my friend, I will be able to tell you everything you desire to know. I am very close now to piecing together all the different parts of this puzzle. There are, however, certain things I must do, and things also that you must do. I thought there might be, I muttered, thinking, not for the first time, how lucky it was that my boss at Scotland Yard held Poirot in such high esteem. My other cases would quietly be reassigned to colleagues, enabling me to devote myself entirely to helping Poirot for as long as he needed me. Tell me first about the day of Frank Devonport's murder, he said. You have spoken to everybody, I hope, and taken down their accounts. Yes, and it all seems straightforward. Nobody's version of the 6th of December contradicts anybody else's. Oliver Proud left for London very early in the morning. Shortly after 9, Daisy and Richard Devonport and the Laviolettes set off for Kingfisher's View, the Semleys' house, where they arrived at 9:30. Frank arrived at Little Quay at 10 o'clock with Helen Acton. They spent the morning there with Lillian and Sidney Devonport. A little before 2, Oliver returned from London and went to Kingfisher's View, as instructed. Then at 2, Winnie Lord arrived to tell the exiles that they could now return. Daisy, Richard and Verna Laviolette did return then, but Oliver and Godfrey did not. They set off at 5 o'clock from Kingfisher's View, with Percy Semley in tow. Semley invited himself along, apparently. He'd heard wonderful stories about Frank from various Kingfisher Hill people and wanted to meet him. Neither Godfrey Laviolette nor Oliver Proud had the courage to tell him that his presence would not be welcome. Meanwhile, back at Little Quay, everyone had congregated in the drawing room at around 2:20, when Daisy, Richard and Verna returned from Kingfisher's View. Present for this drawing-room gathering, therefore, were all 5 Devonports, Frank, Richard, Daisy, Sidney and Lillian, as well as Helen Acton and Verna Laviolette. Winnie Lord came in and out to serve refreshments and clear away afterwards. Excellent. All is as I expected, said Poirot. Continue. I shivered. Speaking at length made even slow swimming impossible, and I was getting cold. Everyone agrees that Helen Acton left the drawing room at around 4 o'clock. She was tired, she said, and needed to rest before dinner. She went upstairs. Around 10 to 15 minutes later, other people started to leave the drawing room. Verna Laviolette, Sidney, Lillian, and Daisy all went upstairs to their bedrooms. Frank also went upstairs, but to Helen's room, not his own. At around 4:30, before going up to her room, Daisy sent Winnie Lord to Kingfisher's View to retrieve Oliver. Richard Devonport, who did not go upstairs after everyone left the drawing room, he went to the library. Says that Winnie arrived back from Kingfisher's View at 5:30. With her were 3 men, Oliver Proud, Godfrey Laviolette, and Percy Semley. Richard heard their voices from the library. Then, according to Richard Davenport, he was alone in the library for some time. Yes. He claims to have heard Winnie say that she had to get on with preparing dinner, and after that he only heard the voices of the three men until... well, until Frank fell from the balcony and Helen came running down the stairs, crying, "Oliver, I did it, I killed him." As to the precise wording of her confession, there is some disagreement, but all versions have Helen Acton freely admitting that she pushed Frank from the balcony. "Poirot, if I'm not swimming, I must get out and wrap myself in those towels," I pointed at them. "Better still, let's go back to Little Quay and continue the conversation there." "Your account so far has been most informative," he said. "I wish now to hear in more detail about these 10 minutes between 5:30 and 6:20. The interruption of returning to the house will not be helpful to my train of thought." "Poirot, the blood in my veins is almost blue from the cold," I pointed at my arm. "So I see. Alas, it will prove impossible to make me responsible for this turn of events, however hard you try, Catchpole. It was not Poirot who persuaded you to plunge into an expanse of cold water. Please continue."
"I shall remember this," I told him.
With a sigh, I sank back into the water up to my neck and made a series of vigorous movements with my arms and legs to stimulate the circulation.
"After 5:30 is where the accounts start to differ. Daisy said that she heard Oliver's voice and knew that he'd returned. When she went out onto the landing, she saw that he'd brought Percy Semley with him, and she was angry. Semley was not invited, and it was inappropriate for Oliver to have brought him. At that point, according to Daisy, Helen's bedroom door opened. Frank emerged. 'Not Helen,' says Daisy. Helen was still inside her bedroom. From the balconied landing, Frank saw Semley, Godfrey LaViolette, and Oliver Proud downstairs in the entrance hall and moved towards the stairs, clearly intending to join them. Daisy claims that this was the moment when she resolved to take action to protect her family from the danger presented by Frank's return. She pushed him violently over the balcony. He fell and, well, we know what happened to him after that. Daisy doesn't understand what happened next, she told me. Suddenly Helen was at her side. She had not heard Helen come out of her bedroom. And then, to Daisy's astonishment, something happened that made no sense. Helen hurried down the stairs and confessed to Frank's murder. By now, having heard the great crash and the exclamations of the men downstairs, everybody who was not standing in the entrance hall was on the landing. Not only Daisy, but also Verna LaViolette and Sidney and Lillian Devonport. Richard Devonport came out of the library and ran over to where his brother's body lay. The only person who did not appear was Winnie Lord. She must still have been busy in the kitchen and not heard the commotion. As to the people on the landing, watching from the balcony, well, here we encounter a problem. The accounts given by Verna, Sidney and Lillian are all different from each other and also from what Daisy told me.
How are they different? Asked Poirot.
I had established a good rhythm for my arm and leg movements and was warming up somewhat. Verna's version is the most interesting. She says Helen Acton cannot have pushed Frank, and neither can Daisy have done it, because Frank was already falling in mid-air when Helen and Daisy stepped out of their bedrooms. She says she would swear to that. When I asked her who might have pushed Frank, she said, without hesitation, Lillian. She was standing close enough to have done it. Sidney Devonport was there too, Verna said, though he was further away. But she conceded that he might also have pushed Frank while Lillian stood by and watched. I don't know about you, but I scarcely find it credible that, having finally decided to give Frank his trespasses...
Ah, but if Sidney and Lillian murdered him, then the charade of forgiveness and reconciliation would have been a sham, n'est-ce pas?
I suppose so, I said doubtfully. All the same, what Verna told me was very different from what I was told by Sidney, Lillian and Daisy. Sidney and Lillian said that when they emerged from their rooms, Helen was standing on the landing and Frank was already falling. They both say that Daisy appeared a moment or two later as Frank was about to hit the ground. Meanwhile, Daisy says that her parents were not on the landing at all, neither of them, or if they were, she didn't notice them there. She says that she pushed Frank and was aware of Verna's presence, and a few seconds later, Helen's, but claims she did not see either Sidney or Lillian up on the balcony, until she'd followed Helen down the stairs. As for the assembled hordes downstairs in the entrance hall, none of them looked up before Frank landed, as it were, so they were of no use in determining who appeared on the balcony, when and in what order.
"You have made the excellent report, my friend," said Poirot with satisfaction. "You may now get out of the water if you wish. We must waste no time, for there is much to do. And I am afraid that I must leave you alone at Kingfisher Hill for a short while."
"Why?" I asked as I wrapped the two towels around me. They weren't much use on the warming front. I was colder out of the water than in it.
"Our dead woman from the coach," said Poirot. "I must visit her next of kin."
"Joan Blythe? But do you mean her aunt in Cobham?"
"She has no such relation. It is her mother that I intend to visit, in order to ask her about her daughter's green coat and hat. Your Sergeant Gidley has been most helpful in providing me with an address. After that, my next appointment will be with the doctor of the late Otto Proud, Dr. Alexander F. Grave of Harley Street. I shall speak to him, and then I shall visit Coutts Bank to discuss the financial affairs of Godfrey LaViolette with his banker. Finally, I shall visit the offices of the publisher of a certain book."
"Midnight gathering, I guessed." Poirot smiled. "Well done, Catchpool. Your swim appears to have improved the functioning of your little grey cells. It is a happy day indeed, for I am nearly certain of what will result from all of the inquiries I am about to make. I am unlikely to be wrong." Seeing my expression of helpless frustration, he said, "You too could be in a similarly fortuitous position if you would only apply your mind to the problem at hand. Here, I will give you the hand of the helper. Think, my friend. Midnight gathering the book, where it was when you first saw it. Think of what Daisy Devonport told me on the coach about it being a gift. You repeated her very words to me only minutes ago, so I know that you remember them. Then recall Helen Acton's confession, seconds after Frank fell to his death. What did she say to Oliver Proud when she ran down the stairs?" "Yes, but what do all of these things have to do with each other?"
I shivered in my towels, envying Poirot his thick coat, hat, and gloves. "That is the question we must answer."
His tone was one of cheerful anticipation, not dread.
"Think of Oliver Proud's confessions to Godfrey LaViolette, as described to me by Esther Semley. Think of Helen Acton pretending to be tired in order to escape from the Devonports' unwelcoming company. She went to her bedroom, did she not? Then we have the two houses, Kingfisher's View and Little Key. Why did the Devonports buy the LaViolette's house and not Esther Semley's? And a more vital question still, why did the LaViolettes want to sell their home at Kingfisher Hill? Only one thing changed on the estate immediately before they decided they wished to sell their property here. One detail that could hardly be significant, the replacing of the gate porter. And do not forget Lavinia Stent."
"I suspect you of toying with me, Poirot. Are you deliberately filling my head with useless trivialities?"
"Non, pas du tout.
I fail to see how Lavinia Stent, a woman who agreed with Hester Semley, though ineffectively, about the unsuitability of the new gate porter, might be involved in either the murder of Frank Devonport or the murder of Joan Blythe."
Poirot nodded briskly. "Do not worry, my friend. I anticipated that you would not be able or willing to do the necessary thinking, so I have prepared for you a list of important tasks. Work your way through these items, and you will help to move our investigation further forward, even if you understand only minimally. Simply do as I ask, following my instructions to the letter, and record accurately and in detail what results from your actions. This, surely, you are able to do." Poirot refused to hand over the list until I was dry and dressed. Once I was in a state of readiness that I hoped he would deem acceptable, I followed his first instruction and knocked on the door of his room at Little Key, which I had learned yesterday from Werner LaViolette was the one that Helen Acton had been assigned on the one unhappy occasion that she had come here. Werner told me that I'd been allocated Frank Devonport's room, and I had so far searched it twice in the hope of finding something helpful. Alas, I had found nothing. Poirot and I had been given this temporary accommodation at Little Quay in order that we could pursue our investigation, though it was clear we were not welcome. Sidney Devonport growled whenever he came upon either of us by chance, then turned and walked in the opposite direction. Daisy, depending on her mood, either glared at us or smirked as if she knew something we did not. Lillian and Richard Devonport both avoided our eye, and Godfrey LaViolette had been very little in evidence. He'd taken to locking himself into the room known as Peepers HQ for hours on end. Sidney, by contrast, had not been near that room, and appeared to have lost all interest in his once-cherished board game. Oliver Proud had at first been at our heels all the time, asking to be let in on the details of what we were doing and what was our current thinking about both murders. Then his manner had changed to one of frosty resentment as soon as he saw that Poirot and I were not going to include him in our deliberations. The only person who seemed pleased to have us around was Werner LaViolette, who was happy to converse with us at length without demanding anything in return. It was strange. When I had first heard her described as kind, I had been unable to imagine it. She had seemed to me then to be acerbic and too sharp-edged to be capable of much kindness. More recently, though, I was noticing a softer side to her. With no servants in the house, now that both Winnie and her scrawny replacement had gone, Werner, assisted by Daisy, was preparing all the food, and it was Werner who served every meal to Poirot and me. We had eaten on our own in the morning room since our return to Little Quay, partly because it was our preference, but mainly because Sidney Devonport had made it clear that he did not wish to share his dining room with us. Quite often, Werner opted to keep us company and eat with us instead of with her husband and the Devonports. On these occasions, her manner was markedly less spiky than it had once been. Tragedy and disaster are said to bring out the best in some people. Perhaps she was one of them. Poirot did not respond to my first knock at his door, so I tried again. This time he answered immediately. Ah, Catchpole. Come in, come in. Let me see this list of tasks, then, I said with a strong sense of foreboding. I was not afraid of expending effort or energy, but knowing Poirot well by now, I had no doubt that he was capable of asking me to do absolutely anything, the possible and the impossible. Since meeting him, I felt much less in command of my own life, and am always poised for some new surprise or adventure. It is exciting and often stimulating, but also rather hard on the nerves. Poirot handed me a piece of paper, and I cast my eye over the list he had made for me. It read as follows. Tasks for Catchpole. 1. Find out who gave the book Midnight Gathering to Daisy Devonport as a gift. 2. Also ask Daisy, why did her father allow Richard to propose marriage to Helen Acton and to remain engaged to her when she had murdered his son? 3. Also, if Frank was so evil and dangerous that Daisy needed to kill him to protect her family from further betrayals, why then did she agree to marry his collaborator in the theft, Oliver Proud? This is a contradiction that makes no sense. 4. Why did Sidney and Lillian Devonport want to see Frank and Helen alone for several hours on the morning of Frank's murder? 5. Did anybody hear any arguments or raised voices in the hour before Frank was pushed to his death? 6. Was suicide ever considered by anybody as an explanation for Frank's death? 7. Make a list of all who were present at Little Quay at the time of Frank's death. For each of the 10, write down a possible motive for murder. I read the 7 items on the list 3 times. Then I said to Poirot, 10 people? I did a quick calculation in my mind. You're including Percy Semley. Mais oui, he was present. But he was downstairs. He, Oliver, Godfrey LaViolette, Richard, Winnie Lord, they were all downstairs and cannot possibly have pushed Frank from the balcony. This is true, Poirot agreed. Then he said, unless some of the information we have been given is false.
Which brings me to the next problem, I said. I shall do my best to get the answers you want, but you realise, I hope, that I can only ask questions. I have no way of making anybody answer, or answer truthfully.
Of course you have the way. Are you not the Scotland Yard inspector in charge of both murder investigations?
Theoretically, yes, I sighed. You know I'm hardly the most authoritative chap at the best of times, Poirot, and it's so much harder in this house of all places. Every time I think about my first visit here, the ridiculous story you told Sidney Davenport about our deep interest in peepers, I shudder with embarrassment. It's a uniquely uncomfortable position to be in, to demand utmost veracity from those you have shamelessly deceived.
Oh, your English with your excessively developed sense of shame, said Poirot. Do not worry that people may lie to you. That will be as useful as if they tell the truth. Now, there is one more thing that I have not added to the list. It is something that I want you to tell Daisy Davenport, but not at the same time that you ask her these other questions. This is vitally important, Catchpool. It is why I have not put the final item on the list. Only once you have already done everything on the list should you proceed to this last instruction.
What is it? I asked.
You are to tell Mademoiselle Daisy that you have received a telegram from Sergeant Gidley.
That says what?
That Ellen Acton has retracted her confession. She now admits, finally, that she did not murder Frank Davenport. What is more, she agrees that Daisy did, and that she saw Daisy push Frank in a most violent fashion.
None of this is true, is it?
It is wholly untrue, Poirot announced with pride. It is my little invention. Please be as meticulous as possible when recording its effects.
Shortly after issuing this order, Poirot set off for London with the help of our old friend, Mr. Alfred Bixby, and the Kingfisher Coach Company. Tempted as I was to retreat to my quarters and avoid the rest of the household, I steeled myself and worked my way through the list of tasks that Poirot had assigned to me. On several fronts, I was unlucky, or at least unsuccessful. Poirot would no doubt have reminded me that mental attitude, order, and method were more closely linked to success than was luck. No one offered me any sort of answer to questions 2, 3, and 4 on Poirot's list. Daisy scowled at me as if I were a rat that had appeared on her dinner plate when I asked her to explain the discrepancy of her being willing to marry Oliver Proud at the same time as wanting to kill Frank for his betrayal. One look at her face was enough to make me give up all hope of getting an answer out of her. In answer to the question of why Sidney and Lillian had wanted Frank and Helen all to themselves for the morning, everyone I asked said the same thing, apart from Sidney, who turned and marched off without a word. There was no particular reason. They had simply wanted it because they wanted it. Asked on a separate occasion why he had allowed the two engagements, Daisy's to Oliver and Richard's to Helen, Sidney Davenport had barked at me, "Mind your own damn business." Daisy had said, "I suspect you are too stupid and lacking in experience to understand, even if I were willing to explain it to you, which I am not." Richard had mumbled something to the effect that it was not his place to try to understand his father. "The truth is, I cannot make sense of my own behaviour most of the time," he said. The suggestion that Frank Davenport might have taken his own life by choice was met with voluble derision from all quarters. No one had loved life more than Frank, I was told by all. I had more success in relation to items 1 and 5 on Poirot's list. Everybody, apart from Sidney, was happy to inform me that they had not heard any arguments, raised voices, or anything untoward in the house in the hour before Frank's death, or at any time during the day. I had the impression that they were all telling the truth on this point. As for Midnight Gathering, nobody could tell me who had given Daisy her copy of the book, though Oliver Proud and Verna Laviolette both volunteered that Daisy had given them a copy as a gift. Oliver's, he said, was presently in his house in London, and Verna told me hers was at Harriet Semley's house, which, of course, I already knew. Daisy, when asked, took the opportunity to tease me. A man called Humphrey gave it to me.
Then she laughed and said, I am talking nonsense, Inspector Catchpole. Nobody gave it to me. I gave it to myself. There is no such person as Humphrey.
I reminded her that she had told Poirot the book had been a gift. She merely shrugged and said, I must have been lying. I probably decided it was none of his business and made something up.
Throughout all of my exchanges with Daisy Devonport, she made it abundantly clear that she was not afraid of me or of anything much. Her manner seemed to say, I have confessed to the murder of my brother already, so there is really nothing else for me to be afraid of. When I attempted item 7, the list of motives, I found some people easier than others to invent motives for. Frank Devonport's murder. Possible motives for those present. Sydney Devonport, on balcony at time of Frank's death, revenge for the theft. Frank was thriving, and Sydney decided after some time that mere banishment from the family was not sufficient punishment. He lured Frank back home with talk of a second chance, but his intention was always to murder him. Lillian Devonport, on balcony at time of Frank's death. Exactly the same motive as above, possibly shared with Sydney, if they acted together, or, highly unlikely but just about possible given the madness into which some people descend, Lillian could not bear to abandon her most beloved child, and she knew she had not long to live. She wanted to take Frank with her, as it were. Helen Acton, on balcony at time of Frank's death, cannot think of a motive, unless her lie about falling in love with Richard Devonport was a double bluff. Perhaps, unbeknownst to the rest of the family, the two of them had been acquainted for some time and grown to love one another. Why this would require Helen to kill Frank, rather than simply end her engagement to him, I cannot imagine. Daisy Devonport, on balcony at time of Frank's death. Her stated motive. She had convinced herself that Frank presented a grave danger to the family, perhaps also revenge for the theft, if she saw her parents' money as also hers. Richard Devonport, in library at time of Frank's death. As the less stellar Devonport brother, did he perhaps fear that Frank's return would eclipse him altogether? That Frank would once again run Sydney's business affairs and he, Richard, would be ousted? Also, maybe revenge for theft of family money. Oliver Proud, in entrance hall below balcony at time of Frank's death. Jealousy of Daisy's affection for Frank, as Hester Semley described to Poirot. Fear that Daisy would lose interest in him now that Frank had returned. Winnie Lord, in kitchen at time of Frank's death. Exactly the same motive as Oliver Proud, according to Hester Semley. Godfrey Laviolette, in entrance hall below balcony at time of Frank's death. Cannot think of any possible reason, unless related to the Laviolette's secret reason for wishing to leave Kingfisher Hill. Verna Laviolette, on balcony at time of Frank's death. Same as for Godfrey above. Percy Semley, in entrance hall below balcony at time of Frank's death. Cannot think of any motive Percy might have had. I reread what I had written for each person. Whoever it was, why did they do it in front of a large audience? I said aloud to myself. People on the balcony landing, people in the hall below, it could hardly have been more public. Why? As for Joan Blythe from the coach, I could think of no reason why any Devonport, Laviolette, Lord, Proud, or Semley should want to bludgeon her to death so violently. I waited until the following morning to tackle the final task that Poirot had assigned me, the one he deemed so important that he had not put it on the list at all. After breakfast, I set off in search of Daisy. I found her in the peeper's room, sitting in a chair by the window, staring out at the garden. Not you again, she said flatly. More questions, I suppose? No. There is news that I thought you would want to hear immediately from Sergeant Gidley. It arrived by telegram a few minutes ago. What news? She stood up. My expression must have alarmed her. It had occurred to me as I was speaking, and therefore too late, that she might demand to see the telegram. What would I do in that eventuality? The answer came to me, I would refuse, of course. If Gidley had sent me a telegram, I would be under no obligation to show it to anybody.
Helen Acton has admitted to lying, I said.
Lying? Daisy walked slowly towards me.
Lying about what?
She has retracted her confession. She now admits that she did not murder Frank, and has given a new statement in which she says that... I cleared my throat.
Poirot would have been able to pull off this act with far more aplomb. Still, that was no use to me. He was in London. I was the one staring into the avid, relentless eyes of Daisy Devonport.
Helen Acton has confirmed that you are telling the truth. You were the one who pushed Frank, and she saw you do it, I said.
There, it was done.
Daisy gasped. Her hands started to shake.
I appreciate that it must be rather a shock, I said.
Where is Poirot?
She said, in a new, ragged voice that I had not heard before.
I need to speak to him as a matter of urgency.
He's gone to take care of some business in London. Anything you wish to tell him, you can tell me. He and I are...
Bring him back, said Daisy. I need to speak to him now. Right now.